From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump gave his second State of the Union address on Tuesday night. It was the third time he addressed a joint session of Congress. His address was delayed by a week because of the record-breaking government shutdown. Many Democratic female lawmakers wore white to the speech, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The coordinated clothing was apparently a tribute to suffragettes and women's rights. Trump spoke at length, largely sticking to a script. He began by calling for an end to divisiveness, touted the economic miracle that he claims to have ushered in, and showcased the Criminal Justice Reform Act he championed. Then he pivoted to the topic that was expected to be the major focus of his State of the Union, his obsession with funding for a border wall. Trump did not declare a national emergency to obtain his funding without congressional approval, as he hinted he might. On foreign policy issues, Trump also addressed the U.S. Embassy in Israel, the crisis in Venezuela, a warming of ties with North Korea, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and his animosity toward Iran. We turn now to Rosa Clemente, a community organizer, freelance journalist. She was the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate and currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at UMass Amherst. She's also a news correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Rosa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, Trump, of course, started out with this message of unity, which is what was previewed by White House spokespeople ahead of the State of the Union. He talked about compromising and the common good and bridging old divisions, and we can choose between greatness or gridlock. And he said, tonight, I ask you to choose greatness. He returned to that theme near the end of his speech. How ironic is it to hear such sentiments from somebody like him?
Yeah, I mean, I just was watching it, you know, from start to finish, and I don't think people are taking seriously enough what he's doing, because I think one thing that we should all be up in arms about is this made-up story of a governor allowing a child to be killed after they were born as part of late-term abortion. I think the things he said around reproductive rights alarm me the most at this moment, because that's something that is not usually the topic of conversation when it comes to Trump. Either it's a very Russia-centered topic that's coming out from liberals, or it's a very supportive way that people see him, especially working class white people. And so I think it's not only ironic, it's like watching fascism just come more to life. You know, I found it very disturbing. I found any levity of people, especially Democrats, standing up to clap, you know, I find that all terrible, because it kind of makes me feel that this is going to obviously get worse, and I'm not sure if we're ready for what Trump is going to bring down, starting with the wall.
What do you make of this statement that women made wearing white? House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wore white. You could see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wearing white. And when Trump touted the economic miracle that women were benefiting from, discussing how women were basically, you know, having the lowest unemployment rates ever, and then talking about the record-breaking number of women serving in Congress, the women wearing white stood up and clapped, and that even threw Trump off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I that's what I found the most disturbing of the entire night. Again, this is not a time for levity. The reason those women won is because they carried an anti-Trump message, even if they were never naming the president. And I feel like if people are going to, you know, sit there, especially women and women of color, I think there's the time for civility is over, because there's nothing civil about the policies he is pushing forward. The only thing is that they sound less intrusive and dangerous and invasive when it's couched in a speech and couched within this always having manners and civility when dealing with particularly political people. And so, you know, I don't know why they would stand up. I mean, I know if I was there, I wouldn't come, you know, and I think we're beyond symbolism at this point. Okay, you were white. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that tomorrow he's going to change his mind or the people in his administration about anything they're doing. And I think that's very, very dangerous.
Right. There were a handful of Democrats who boycotted the speech, but very small numbers. Let's talk about how he interestingly pivoted from criminal justice reform to the border. He touted the case of Alice Johnson, and in fact, she was one of his invited guests. This was a Black woman whose sentence he commuted. He had his Kim Kardashian moment with her, and he signed this First Step Act that is a modest step towards criminal justice reform. He also then introduced a man named Matthew Charles, who he says is the first person to have been freed under the First Step Act. Then he pivoted straight to the border. What do you make of him juxtaposing Alice Johnson and Matthew Charles with the border crisis?
Yeah, I mean, first, he's co-opting the message of years and decades of work around mass incarceration. Second, the First Act was really criticized by a lot of left and radical and younger people, leaders, who say that it does help federal sentences, but it does nothing on a local level, and that for 25 years, we've been fighting this fight. And,
right. The majority of people incarcerated are done so in state prisons, right?
Right. Not in federal prisons. But either way, you know, the Republicans are good at co-opting it. I mean, they did it. Let me just say this for a second. They did it right now with saying everything they wanted for health insurance. And it was like hearing Obamacare, right? Like, they co-opted that whole message right now in this speech. That's why I say he's masterful. It's sinister, and I find it to be psychopathic and like a megalomaniac, but he's masterful at what he does, you know. And I think in him changing it or pivoting, like you said, to the border wall, right? I don't know if he was trying to make a connection with those two. I think what he was saying in general is that we shouldn't be locking up like our own citizens or our people. There's other ways, there's reform and all these other things. But if you come across the southern border, you're automatically designated a criminal and devoid of your human rights. I mean, right now, there's still 3,000 children that are separated from their parents, and he's not moving on the wall. And I've heard and read a couple things that make me think that the Democrats might actually capitulate a little bit to this. And if they do, their base is going to hopefully will rise up. But I think that's what they're preparing for.
Let's actually watch what Trump said on the issue of the border. This is from the State of the Union address on Tuesday night.
My administration has sent to Congress a common sense proposal to end the crisis on the southern border. It includes humanitarian assistance, more law enforcement, drug detection at our ports, closing loopholes that enable child smuggling, and plans for a new physical barrier or wall to secure the vast areas between our ports of entry. In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
And And that is Donald Trump on Tuesday night speaking to a joint session of Congress as part of a State of the Union address. Rosa Clemente is my guest. One of the things that he said that alluded to the fact that the Democrats have a tough time taking a principled stand on this is that most of the people in this room voted for a wall once upon a time. And it's true. Many Democrats have backed that in the past. But he also, I'm wondering what your response is to the fact that he has also attempted to sympathize or cast the immigrant women and children who are victimized by drug smugglers and sex traffickers at the same time that, of course, his own administration has victimized them, locked them up, separated them. And we're supposed to believe that he actually cares about immigrant women and children.
Right. I mean, he doesn't care about American women. So for the most part, he's not going to care about who he obviously in his administration see as subhuman. I mean, that's the only way someone could justify this policy. And I think we have to be very clear on making sure that in spaces that we're at, specifically as organizers, that we really talk about the danger of his presidency. And like I said, I mean, these are always for show anyway. We all know this, especially us who follow it. But it also sets the tone in the nation. And right now, there's probably a lot of people that support Trump to now feel more emboldened and dig in. And I'm not sure the Democrats will stand up the way they should. And, you know, even though they have some more progressive left-leaning, especially congresswomen, we don't have enough numbers in there to stop something from moving forward. That's a bad policy, except our organizing, you know. And even with that, we have to be very clear that we're letting people know where we are politically. To say that we can see fascism become more popularized in this weird way of him being able to talk to that, quote, everyday American, we have to have that political education. If not, people just take him as a joke. And again, I think that's dangerous in itself.
Right. He pitted working class Americans against undocumented immigrants, saying that working class Americans are left to pay the price for, quote, illegal immigration. And he also said, I want people to come into this country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally. And of course, this has been a standard talking point on the right, hasn't it? That, you know, get in line as if there is a system for legal immigration that actually works for people in seeking asylum, people seeking a better life. It is such a tremendously difficult process to emigrate.
Yeah, and you know, everything he said about the number of murders that supposedly undocumented people have committed in 1 year in America, that we know that most undocumented people who want to immigrate here, or migrants, excuse me, and migrants, they present themselves at a checkpoint or the port of entry, and they're supposed to be given a political asylum. You know, so I think he's preparing his base to go and support him if he moves on the national emergency. That's an emergency alert that he, not alert, policy that he would want to put in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's when the Democrats are really going to have to stand their ground. And we have to be ready for that moment. Mm-hmm.
Near the end of his speech, he during the foreign policy section, he brought up, of course, predictably Venezuela, where he denounced President Nicolas Maduro's socialism, blamed it for destroying the country, and then talked about, sort of conflated socialism in Venezuela with the popularity of socialism here in the United States. And he said, we are born free, we will stay free, which was then followed by the USA, USA chants, which appeared several times. That nationalistic chant appeared several times during the speech. And he said, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country. I was kind of surprised that he would bring this up, but I'm wondering if this is a fear about the popularity of socialism in the U.S.
I mean, it's a fear because every time a congresswoman or Ocasio-Cortez tweets, she's absolutely right. And, you know, that's a pointed, direct, I believe that was made for her to hear that from the president, as well as obviously Bernie Sanders and a couple other Congress people that would lean more to the left. And, you know, I think we have to talk about what socialism is. If it's about everyone having health care, everybody having a right to a good education, everybody having right to affordable housing, everyone having dignity in the workplace, then, you know, of course, socialism is popular because it takes care of the good, the entirety of who we are. Whereas capitalism, you know, is obviously failing for the majority of us, but not for the 1%, even the 1% of the 1%. And that's who he's also talking to. You know, a lot of these people are afraid of Ocasio-Cortez because she wants to tax certain people. And they actually just did a survey where a lot of Republicans feel the same way.
Right. Fox News conducted a survey and they were shocked by the fact that their own viewers thought that higher taxes on the rich was a good idea.
Right. And that's because most of his base is not our working class and middle class people that are harboring an anxiety and a fear over whiteness, over how whiteness is being deconstructed, over how their own children are beginning to question white privilege and make all those systemic connections, you know. But I'm sure, you know, I live in Albany. If I go outside the door and ask a lot of Republicans, don't you think we should tax the rich and have some form of free health care for all? Of course they would say yes. You know, so that's why what the Republicans are doing right now is gaslighting, and they're brilliant at it. I don't know what the Democrats, I know that they need to step up in ways we haven't seen them step up before, or we're just going to be worse in policy by the time he gives this address next year.
Well, Rosa, let's hope there is no next year when it comes to the State of the Union address.
And I think that's where, you know, we have to go. No matter what political stripe, above progressives we are, left, radical, vote, don't vote, independent, Green Party, I think there's something now that should make us work in solidarity together. And all his rhetoric, but his actions as well, might be the thing that gets us all working towards getting him out of office, understanding who would be next in line. But that is very necessary right now. We have to resist.
Rosa, thank you as always for joining us today. I really appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Rosa Clemente, community organizer, freelance journalist, and the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate, currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at UMass Amherst, and a news correspondent for our program. We've been analyzing Trump's State of the Union address. We continue our coverage of the 2019 State of the Union Address now with Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news. Welcome to the program, Jody. So it's you and I are talking on the night of the State of the Union Address. It's been a long night. First, your general impressions of Trump's speech. He did not declare a national emergency for the border wall funding as was expected. He did make wild claims about New York's recent abortion law.
Yes. Well, I'm not surprised he didn't make an emergency declaration. Actually, I think he needs something to constantly threaten, and I think he's been threatening with that. And it's been clear in the past couple of days that Republican senators are not going to go along with it. So they've been putting a lot of pressure on him not to declare this emergency, ironically, because they're afraid that a Democratic president might actually use it for a real emergency, like climate disasters. But I didn't actually expect him to do it tonight. I expect him to continue to use the issue to stir up hatred and resentment, because that's all he really knows how to do. So I think that I'm not surprised that on Tuesday he did not say anything about that. He did. I think the speech was, from my vantage point, incredibly rambling, incredibly incoherent. It skipped from thing to thing to thing. And really it was, you know, it's sort of both frustrating and insulting at the same time when you have someone who's, for example, using childhood cancer as a prop for a speech, right, when he's taking away healthcare from millions of people, or use, you know, in one part of a speech talking about immigrants, asylum seekers, and dehumanizing them, and then, you know, sentences later talking about cherishing all life. It's really like an out-of-body experience, and I find it personally, as a person who works from evidence, I find it personally very painful, actually, in a way, painful.
Right. Sadly, of course, his supporters have internalized that cognitive dissonance because they embody it as well. Well, let's play a clip from the speech that he gave Tuesday night, where he specifically referred to the abortion law that the state of New York recently passed and that has become this talking point among Republicans that are, of course, going to use this as a way to gain political points. Here is President Trump Tuesday night.
Lawmakers in New York cheered with delight upon the passage of legislation that would allow a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb moments from birth. These are living, feeling, beautiful babies who will never get the chance to share their love and their dreams with the world. And then we had the case of the governor of Virginia, where he stated he would execute a baby after birth. To defend the dignity of every person, I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb.
And that is President Trump on Tuesday night speaking to loud cheers from the Republican section, talking about wanting to pass legislation to prohibit late-term abortion. All of the Democratic women who were there wearing white sat and did not clap. And Jody Jacobson, who you wrote recently about this issue, saying that the media reporting on this issue has been terrible, and I'm sure they're not going to, there isn't going to be enough critical coverage the day after the State of the Union address on some of these claims he made. So he's claiming that the State of New York has allowed legislation, has passed legislation allowing a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb moments before birth. What's the reality?
The reality is that that is false. There are very few third trimester abortions. Approximately 90% of all abortions happen in the first trimester, and the majority share of those happen before 8 weeks. Then you get into second trimester abortions, which happen, you know, up until about 28 weeks. And then third trimester abortions, which are really oftentimes not abortions, but the far right plays them that way, are something like a fetus dies in utero and you have to deliver it. And sometimes delivering it means you have to perform a certain kind of abortion procedure because you have to ensure that the woman has the safest procedure for her. Or in the case of, for example, Northam, who was really talking about—
This is the governor of Virginia who's under fire Northam, for a racist photo.
Exactly. Before the racist incident, he misspoke. He's not an OBGYN. He's not an abortion provider. He's a pediatrician, but he is pro-choice. He misspoke about he spoke inelegantly, I think, about what he was talking about, which is an incident in where you would have a baby that was delivered and was not viable. And so it won't live. And what you're saying is you keep the baby comfortable. Just like when my brother was dying, we sought to keep him comfortable. So it was taken, as anything like this will be, by the right to twist it because they need to deflect from all of their own failed policies. And obviously what they want to do is ban abortion, period. It doesn't matter what trimester, what day, what cause, what consequence for women or their families. They want to ban abortion, period. Otherwise, they wouldn't have these six-week abortion bans and other things going through the courts. But it's I really feel like the press reporting on this has been awful. One thing is There is no medical term called late-term abortion. You have an early abortion or you have a later abortion. The second thing is that I heard a lot of media types talking about how the Democrats, you know, really went too far out on a limb. Well, here's the reality. We have very few states right now that will certainly have access to abortion care should the Supreme Court overturn Roe, because there are what are called zombie laws in many states, which would be, they're basically on the books, they're sleeper laws, they were overridden by Roe, but they would come back to life. And so they would restrict abortion care in those states. So what New York finally did, and it's been, they've been trying to do it for a while, and what Virginia is trying to do and other states, is secure in their own state law access to abortion care as it stands now. It's really no different than what we have now. It's exactly the same thing, but.
Right. So, so much more to talk about, but I wanna make sure and get in the fact that the response to Trump's State of the Union address was presented by Democrat Stacey Abrams. Every year, the opposition party, whoever is not occupying the White House, the opposition party gives an official response. And this year, Democratic leaders picked the former candidate for the governor of Georgia, Stacey Abrams. What did you make of the fact that they picked her? And what did you make of her response? There were some media reports suggesting that political rising stars that give responses to the State of the Union addresses often find them to be very perilous territory and often end up losing credibility after.
I don't think that was the case at all. She is an extraordinarily good speaker. She's a very authentic speaker, and she has authentic experience from which to draw. Unlike President Trump, she actually has lived many of the experiences she talked about, like being in debt because of healthcare, like having a family that really worked, you know, very, very hard to be in, you know, bring themselves into the middle class. And she also is an expert in her state. She knows her state really well. She knows and has worked for a very long time to ensure that people in her state have the right to vote. She was a legislator, and she was very much respected by people both in both parties. I thought she did an eloquent job of talking about a vision of America that, no matter all of the words, that the word salad that happened at the end of Trump's speech, she came across in a much shorter time with a much more pointed and eloquent vision for the country.
Right. She said the shutdown was a stunt. And I thought that it was really important for her, you know, to use that blunt language. She also painted a much more realistic picture of the economic situation in the country. If you listen to Trump, he talked about the economic miracle, and he spent, a great deal of time touting unemployment figures for African Americans and Hispanics and Asian Americans and how jobs were flooding back. And there's never been anything like it. I mean, he really painted such a fantastical picture, whereas Stacey Abrams talked about plants closing and wages struggling to keep up with the pace of the actual cost of living. She even mentioned the term labor unions.
Right. Well, here's the fact. You know, we know that Trump, you could call him a fabulist, you could call him a liar, which is what I would call him, because I think that's what the truth is. He is a fabulist. He fantasizes about things, and he is, as we all know now, also a narcissist and needs to have the greatest of everything. And so those are the terms in which he speaks about everything. He doesn't have any command of economic policy. He doesn't understand that the number of jobs does not equate to a living wage for people who are working two or three jobs to make ends meet. So if you're working two or three minimum wage jobs, you have no health care protections, you have no paid leave, you have none of the benefits that people need in order to live a semblance of, you know, a stable life. It doesn't matter how many jobs there are, because really what we're talking about is the intersection of employment and sustainable, livable wages. And many people are still in a place where they don't have that.
Well, Jody, so much more that we could spend our time talking about, but we are out of time. And I'm wondering if you can finally close with what I found terribly disturbing, which were these chants of USA, USA throughout the State of the Union. This has repeatedly been seen in previous addresses, but even from previous presidents. It always strikes me as deeply disturbing because it just sounds nationalistic. It sounds like the kind of thing you would see in a totalitarian state. And I'm sure I'll probably piss off some people even saying that, but it rubs me the wrong way. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, I'm not averse to being proud of our country, but I find it chilling in a way that you could have a largely white male party constantly getting up and chanting USA, USA in the exact way you're talking about when they are actively involved in caging and removing children from their families or undercutting benefits that go to low-income children or undercutting, you know, mental health care. I do find it chilling because there is a jingoistic and nationalistic aspect to it and a very male patriarchal aspect to it, a dominant aspect to it that I find very chilling.
It sounds like the chant of a bully, but that's just me. Jody. Rewire.news is the best place to read your writings.
Yes.
And we'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news. We've been discussing President Trump's State of the Union address. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.